What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back. This is America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin, and he is John Krofcik.
Last I looked.
I'm Fenster. He's, what was that show many years ago? I'm Dickens. He's Fenster.
That's what it is. Yeah. Yes, I think you got it.
Marty Ingalls, I remember one, and John Astin. Why did I recall that, John?
I don't know.
I can't remember my own name half the time.
There you go. Wow.
I think, are we both proud products of the public schools?
We are.
Well, that's something of an alliteration. Proud products of public, or it's a construct born out of illiteracy. Whatever it is, thanks to our public schools. So, John, we're going to talk about public education. Now, this is not going to be boring. There are some times that I've attempted in my career in broadcasting to talk about public education, and lots of people said, oh, I don't want to talk about this. Now, we did another podcast kind of bringing us to where we are today to understand how our system built in the way that it did over the many years. And I thought that was really instructive Dr.
Yes.
Costa.
Yep.
So go look for that one. But this one is really interesting because, John, you know that there are different movements that go on that question the very viability of many of the institutions in our society. So, for example, the minimum wage. Sometimes we hear that debated and people say, well, we should index it to the rate of inflation, or we should allow states to have their own, or the federal government should have one. And then there are some people who say, let's just not have one at all, and let's just float and let the employers determine the value of work in their environment.
Yeah, you see, I fall in the middle there. I think a minimum wage is necessary, but I don't think the minimum wage has to be a living wage, like everybody says, because most of the jobs, at least that I see for the minimum wage, are starter-up jobs. They're not jobs you're going to stay at for the rest of your life.
Well, I've always argued that for kids of a certain age, say 18 down to 16, a sub-minimum wage to get them started
right. So
they understand the value of work, and yet we're not pricing them out of their first job, which is a really important experience. My first job was at McDonald's. Hey, it's the first employer. And I got to tell you, I know we're getting a little off track here, but McDonald's, I was the fry and shake guy, John. I never made it to the grill.
Okay. Never. Well, maybe you're better off.
Well, oh no, I thought you were going to say, maybe you can get there now, because a lot of older people are working at McDonald's. But, you know,
you have an opportunity.
I have an opportunity a second time around. But, you know, we used to debate the best way, for example, John, to craft a Medicare program. And now some are talking about eliminating it and transitioning to a coupon system in the private market. The same with Social Security. So a lots of debate about whether we need certain programs that we have. But I think it's a rarity, and I don't know whether you hear it often or ever, that maybe we should do away with public schools.
I don't think we should do that, but I think we need to look at how we do our education now. I think we're out of step with technology, and technology has really taken over now. Then let me say this. I think in earlier grades, we need to take the technology away so that kids can use their brains to start with before we bring the technology.
But then
in,
we've
so.
Got to introduce them
right.
further to the technology, because that's going to be such a big part of their lives.
Right.
I was reading today where adults in America are spending 50% of their waking hours with a device. Is that remarkable?
Yeah, but I think we're doing a podcast on that.
Well, we can do a podcast on everything.
We won't go there for now.
But there are
horrible.
People, John, and there is a movement. I know you may not believe this, but there is a movement questioning the very being and necessity of the K-12 public schools.
Yeah, well, that's surprising. I think we need it, but I think children need a good basics, you know, the reading, writing, arithmetic. I think they need to learn to use their brains young before they're introduced to the machines, and then take it from there.
Well, not that everything you need to know you could have learned or should have learned in kindergarten. We've heard that maxim. But Brian Kaplan, who's with us today, is going to make the case against education, why the education system is a waste of time and money. Now, this is provocative. I mean, it really is.
It is very.
But once you hear Brian, I think it becomes a little more nuanced. What really got my attention was when he said he goes to teachers' nights for his children. So I know he's not totally against the system, but he questions whether, in fact, a lot of time is spent, well, doing things and learning things that you're never going to use or apply in the real world.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think you need the basics. I think you need to learn how to read. You need to learn how to write. You need to do math in case the machine isn't working. You know what I mean? So there are a lot of basics that we do.
Well,
need.
What's interesting is, and I questioned Brian about this in the podcast, you'll hear it. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University, and he's published by the very prestigious Princeton University Press. And so he's had a lot of education. So I think I asked Brian, do you think you wasted a lot of time in the classroom? Well, think about it, John. We're told that we waste a lot of time in our lives. I mean, when I think about the number of hours I have spent doing things that were not terribly productive, and I'm a pretty productive guy, I say, wow, imagine who I could have been had I not done that. Is that true or no?
I don't know. I guess if you realize it while it's happening, you could get it back.
Oh, it's too late.
But it's gone.
I want to go back, but I can't go back, which is a good song by Eddie Money. Well, listen, let's listen to the case against education. Brian Kaplan on America Trends.
On the line with us is Brian Kaplan, a very interesting book called The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. Brian, how determined are you that we either change the system, scrap the system? Because there are so many who would say, this is the bedrock of America, universal access to a public education.
So, like, you know, intellectually, I think that the popular view is just riddled with errors. Am I actually, you know, getting in front of tanks and giving up my life for it? I guess I can't say that. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, like what I say in the case against education is that despite its enormous popularity, we really are wasting an enormous amount of money and time on education that really serves little useful purpose.
Well, let me not bury the headline. Then, if in fact this is the case against education as we know it, then what is the type of education? I mean, you would agree that people need to develop their minds, their skills, their studiousness in terms of wanting to attack new subject matter. So what's a better way to do that than the system we have developed?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the main things that I focus on is just a smaller system where you spend less time in school and leave school at an earlier age. If you were saying, like, what should they do during the time they're there? Mastering literacy and numeracy, which is something that a large number of Americans don't manage to do despite all the years they're spending in school. And then, of course, you know, actually getting prepared to become an independent, self-supporting adult. These are the things that I would think of as crucial. So, you know, literacy, numeracy, and ability to take care of yourself, which again, will often mean that you'll be getting some kind of vocational education in school, although learning by doing, learning on the job through apprenticeships is also greatly undervalued.
Now, to someone who might think that better represents where we were when we had an agrarian society, or one where, you know, basically we needed all hands on deck, we needed children out in the field, and they couldn't get a lot of value from going to school. Today, we hear just the opposite. You need more time in school, you need many more degrees and pedigrees. You say that those are more signals than they are getting value to the individual, and they can acquire a lot of that information, knowledge, and that curiosity on their own.
Right. What I say is, you know, this popular view is half right. Do we need more education than people did 50 years ago? Well, I'd say it depends upon what you really mean by need. Do you need more education to be able to do jobs compared to 50 years ago? And that's what I say, generally not. The kind of training that people got 50 years ago is really what you need to do the job today, because most jobs just haven't changed all that much, actually. We tend to dwell on the jobs like computer scientists, where they've changed tremendously. We tend to forget jobs like waiter, which are, you know, a lot more common and have not changed much at all. But then there's the other sense of, do you need more education to get the job? So there's the education you need to do the job and the education you need to get the job. And it is true that you need a lot more education now to get a job, right? It used to be that many jobs that we consider pretty good you could get right out of high school. Now that's very hard. Now you often need to get a college degree or even more just to be a secretary or something like that. Right, and a lot of what I talk about in the book is, why is there this disconnect between the education that you need to do a job versus the education that you need to get a job? And you're right. The key concept here is called signaling. And the idea is that even if the education that you're doing isn't actually going to be used on the job, even if you can safely forget it right after the final exam, still it's useful for an applicant in order to impress a potential employer, in order to convince an employer they shouldn't throw your application away, they should give you an interview, they should give you a chance. So I say, really, that's what we got today, is a system where you need to spend a lot of time in school in order to impress employers, even though most of what you study is stuff that you would never actually use in the real world.
So, for example, I went and got a master's degree ultimately, but if you ask me about biology or algebra or whatever, calculus, I wouldn't be able to give you a really good answer to most of your questions.
But I
made a living, and I made a life.
Right, and you know, if you ask, well, why is it that you can prosper even though you don't know how to do the stuff that you once knew? And it's because it doesn't come up. So if you don't practice something, then you naturally tend to lose it. You know, a great slogan of my intellectual nemesis, Amy Chua, is, you know, every day you don't practice is the day you get worse. Right, so there's a lot of stuff that we learn in school that never actually comes up again, and very foreseeably never comes up again. It's not just that it was weird or bad luck that it didn't happen to come up again. It's probably almost no one in the class actually uses the material that you're talking about, and yet it's a good way to impress employers. It's a good way to get your foot in the door, right? So people often misunderstand the whole idea of the book, because the subtitle is Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. I'm not saying that individuals are actually making a bad decision. I'm saying that we are in a situation where, in order to do well, you need to get more education than your competitors, even though the education itself is not really going to come up once you actually get the job most of the time.
Now, I must admit, we have interviewed Amy Chua, the Tiger Mom, a couple of times, and your name never came up. But since you raised her name, what is she saying that you're not saying? Because you're both college professors.
Right. So this was, she was sort of my nemesis on my previous book, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, where in her book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, she talked about how important it was for parents to really ride their kids hard so they didn't become losers. And I, in a book, saying that really it's much more about genetics and parents' ability to influence their kids is greatly overrated. So, and we actually did have a debate that was published in The Guardian. So it was a Skype debate. I did have the advantage that I had reread her book the night before the debate, and she had never read my book. I think I had a little bit of a disadvantage, but you can judge for yourself. If you just go and Google my name and Amy Chua, the debate should pop right up, and you can see what you think happened.
All right, that sounds like something very interesting to do. Now that I'm not in a formal educational setting, I have time to do that. Now, let me ask you about that, because you're teaching at the college level at George Mason Economics. Right. And so are you imagining that some of the things you're teaching these kids is unnecessary?
My honest answer is most of what I teach them, the students aren't going to use, unless they become economics professors. Most of the curriculum, it's highly academic, not just literally, but also in the figurative sense, that it's stuff that doesn't really come up in real life very much. Most people who have a job aren't going to go and use what I teach them. The two things that I teach my students that are fairly likely to come up on the job. I teach basic statistics, and then present discounted value, which is a way that you calculate whether or not a business investment is actually worth the money or not. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, those two things aside, most of what I'm doing, I mean, I just have to be honest, it's not something that they're likely to do on the job, unless their job is being an economics professor. If they work in a think tank, something like that, they might use it. But again, I've been hired to go and teach a subject like labor economics, and it's not something where you're likely to use it on a job. I think it's very useful for understanding the world on a deep level if you really take it seriously, but it's not the kind of thing that you would actually get fired for if you didn't know, because it's not germane to most jobs.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. That's right, where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct message us
news.
At Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
What about the value of bringing so many different types of people together for social interaction and acculturation and trying to imbue various cultural norms? Is the public universal free education of value, at least in that regard, in your mind?
Not really. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the ideal that you're talking about sounds great. You know, let's by all means, let's bring everyone together and share all of our ideas and learn from each other. There's just one little problem. We can measure how much this has actually succeeded, right? And by most measures, there's just not much effect of education, certainly on things like instilling appreciation of high culture, which is one of the main aims of the education system, trying to get kids to appreciate literature, poetry, classical music, that kind of thing. And yet we can go and look and see that almost no adults ever voluntarily consume this stuff. It's just not the kind of thing that people enjoy. You can go and try Google Hits for, Kim Kardashian versus David Hume and see how possibly the greatest philosopher who ever lived is, maybe 1/10,000th, but it's a tiny fraction of the attention that is paid to someone who's only famous for being famous, really.
No, I understand that, but what if all of that just went away? I mean, we have a symphony in the city that we're in today, only 100,000 people. It's been going on for over 50 years. It is only subscribed to by a limited number of people, but I know a lot of kids in the schools here in this city are given some access to that, at least. I mean, what if it all just went away, all those good things?
Yeah, I mean, to me, what I'd say is these good things are so small and they affect so few people compared to the cost. And I think we really should think about that cost. So we should think about all the kids who are made to go and suffer through a lot of music that they do not enjoy, and you make them do it for years. And I think we should at least think about those kids at the same time that we're thinking about kids who are inspired and filled with love of music. So, and of course, also the cost to taxpayers. So, I'm a big opera fan. And someone said, wouldn't it be great if we had a big, you know, a big educational program to inspire love of opera? And I would still say, well, like, how many people are you going to inspire and how much is it going to cost?
But what about that one genius? I mean, what about that argument that there's this young child living in a destitute situation? They have no idea what opera is. Their parents never listen to it. And all of a sudden, they are brought to an awareness of it, and they become this prodigy. What about that child?
Right. I mean, so, of course, that's a great story. It's just the question of how much does it cost to go and reach that child, and how many other kids have to go and suffer with opera and not like it in order for that to happen. The other thing I say is that, you know, now that the Internet exists, whatever plausibility these arguments used to have really has just disappeared. Now there is an amazing machine that lets people, that exposes people to anything they're curious about at near zero cost. I mean, the depressing thing, of course, is there can be now an enormous volume of free opera available on YouTube, and yet, you know, the number of people that actually watch it is quite low. But still, just to say, look, now it's free to everyone in unlimited quantity. So as to what the case is for continuing further taxpayer support seems a little bit hard to understand what it is. You know, like the way that I put it in the book is, you know, there's sort of the slogan of we need to give access to everybody. But I think the reality is it's more like we want to go and force everyone to do it, whether they like it or not. And even that's the kind of thing where, just, you know, I think that, you know, it's, you know, there's this noble aim, and then it gets so perverted because people just can't deal with the fact that high culture just doesn't appeal to most people. I mean, like, I mean, remember when I was a kid, this really bothered me. Like, how can everyone not love this stuff? If only I can explain it in just the right way. You know, and I think I had to get into my 20s to realize, like, there's no words I can say to my dad that will make him think that opera is good. Right, there's just nothing, like, it just can't be done. He's just not that kind of a person. Sad, but it's true.
Now, there are certain people within a more conservative or libertarian view who are beginning to adopt this notion that maybe we don't need public schools. For example, there was this host on Fox, Kennedy, and she said there really shouldn't be public schools, should there? I mean, we should really go to a system where parents of every stripe have a choice, have a say in the kind of education their kids get, because when we have centralized bureaucratic education doctrines and dogmas like this, that's exactly what happens. So she's talking about the fact that we don't understand the idea of American exceptionalism. Now, I know there are certain politicians, former Senator Santorum, Senator Rand Paul, who have begun questioning the public education system. But last I looked, we've got this huge enterprise out there governed by states and with guidance from the federal government. And I know we have some somebody in today, Betsy DeVos, who would love to see this change dramatically, but I'm not certain what kind of imprint she's having. So where are we currently along the lines of the reforms that you'd like to see?
I think that the reforms that I'm pushing are very remote. I mean, there's more rhetoric, but, you know, it's just important when you hear a politician talking about something about big changes, just divide by 100 or 1,000 in terms of what you can really expect to happen. I had actually until recently, I believed that Washington State had changed its foreign language requirement to allow a computer language account as a foreign language, mm-hmm. And then I double-checked, and turned out that was only a bill. Right. So again, which to my mind, this is one of the mildest reforms you can imagine. It's just saying, instead of making someone learn Latin, you could go and learn Python instead. Seems like a very sensible adaptation for a modern world where computer languages are very, very are crucial to many occupations, and where people around the world speak English. And yet even this very mild reformist measure, actually contrary to my information, hasn't even happened in any state. Right. So, I mean, you know, so I see a system with enormous inertia, and especially, you know, what I realize and what I talk about in The Case Against Education is that so much education policy is driven by what sounds good without the slightest opportunity for reality to get a word in. So, you know, again, when people talk about foreign languages, they might say, well, it's very important for everyone to learn a foreign language, and in our society we can't afford to do anything less. And it's like, well, what do you mean it's very important? Almost no jobs in the U.S. would require it. And furthermore, in the book I show that almost no American even claims to have learned to speak a foreign language very well in school, even though people generally will spend 2 or 3 years studying one. So it's something where we put years of effort in, and almost no one learns it. And even if they did learn it, they would probably have almost no chance to use it.
But Brian, that's not what I heard.
To say everyone should do it, and it's great.
I heard Gina Haspel the other day talking about the new CIA that she wants to build, and we need people who are linguists who can speak all kinds of languages so they can infiltrate other societies.
Yeah, so you know, there's a small number of jobs like that where they have value. And again, you know, it might make sense to go and take a small number of people and train them to a very high degree, but just going and saying everyone has to do 2 or 3 years of crummy instruction in order to fulfill legal requirements, that's what makes very little sense to me. You know, a lot of what I talk about in the Case Against Education is that, you know, the way that people get good at their jobs isn't by going and studying a bunch of broad things and then magically getting good at something. It's through practicing the specific exact thing that you need to do. So yeah, so if you want to go and train people to be linguists, then you need to go and take a bunch of kids and say, all right, well, if you're interested in foreign languages, then we're going to go and cut a lot of the other requirements so that you have time to actually learn Arabic or time to learn Mandarin or time to learn Korean. So again, that's what you do if you really want to prepare them for their futures, is give them lots of high-quality, intense training rather than just giving them a smattering of a bunch of subjects and then pretending like you've done your job.
But you're a bright guy who's gotten, obviously, a very good education. I mean, what is the purpose of education? Is it really to be vocational and all directed in that way, or is it more about learning more about the classics, learning more about history and humanities, which is now threatened? I mean, what is an educated person, and what's the value of it?
Well, I mean, what I say is, I mean, you're right about me. So, like, you know, like, I love academic stuff. To me, it's fascinating. I mean, if all I knew about it was what I learned in school, I'd know next to nothing because, you know, like, there just wasn't that much taught. I mean, the reason why...
But didn't that give you the incentive to go beyond that and learn more? Would you have been introduced to that? Because if your dad doesn't like opera, I mean, somewhere you were introduced to opera.
I guess the first exposure I did have a general music class, well, I was probably the only kid in that class that actually got interested from that. Would I have been able to do it another way? I don't know. But, you know, like things like history, like the instruction was so uninspiring, I think it was demotivating, but I just picked up some books, and the books were so much better than the classes. In terms of, you know, so, I mean, here's the way that I put it in the book. So, you know, there's really two things that education could do. It could be useful or it can be inspiring. So if it's useful, it doesn't need to be inspiring. So, like, you know, if a kid just doesn't like math, like, well, too bad, because math is really important for real life. And if you don't learn it, you're really cutting off your opportunities at an early age. So we're going to make you do that whether you like it or not. But on the other hand, there's a lot of other subjects where really the only purpose of them would be to inspire people. And, you know, like, on both counts, I think we should go and take a look at, first of all, like, are people being taught the useful skills they need to know? And secondly, like, are they actually being inspired by the material, right? And like I said, like, as long as you've got one out of two, if it's, you know, if it's useful, it doesn't need to be inspiring. If it's inspiring, it doesn't need to be useful. But if it's neither, then that's the problem.
So is that what we've built?
That describes so much of what goes on.
Okay, that's what we've built. So let's rebuild it, and I'm going to name you the Education Secretary because Betsy DeVos isn't having the best time at this. What would Brian Kaplan be doing today to encourage a different way of thinking and that either-or inspiring or useful?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, a big part of it would just be cutting out stuff that isn't either. Right, so that's always where I start. Is let's start by cutting stuff that isn't working, because honestly, that's the easiest thing to do. Right, so I mean, people tend to want to have a full solution before they'll cut anything. What I say is, look, let's just start with what we know. Are we wasting some money? Let's stop doing that. Are we wasting some time? Let's stop doing that. And you know, I think it's not something that, you know, people don't like to hear it. But again, I say, look, let's just go and make a list of the things that we're doing that are a waste of money, and then step one, just stop doing those immediately. And then let's think about whether there's something better that we could be doing with the time instead. I mean, in terms of, like, how I'd redesign it, you know, for young kids, again, like literacy and numeracy, it is shocking how many American adults really are still barely literate and numerate. And probably about a third would be fair after all those years, right? And I think at least part of it is just that they're so unfocused in school. So many subjects are taught. You know, you're going and teaching music and dancing to kids who can't read and write yet, which I think is just... Well, not a good use of their time. Saying, look, like, we've got to go and get the basics down, or else this is a big waste. And then, having electives for kids who are curious. But I think it's also just a shame that kids get so little recess and so little playtime in school now. I mean, it's one thing to say that in modern society where moms work, you need to have schools as daycare. But that doesn't mean they need to be giving, you know, like teaching them in a classroom and boring them all the time. Right, you know, as to why there just couldn't be a lot more recess and playtime as well as just library time, I don't know. And then, you know, when kids are older, I think, you know, there should be, you know, a lot more vocational education. Not the kind where you tell a 12-year-old you're a plumber. But, you know, like tell 12-year-olds, look, we're going to spend the next 40 weeks spending 2 weeks each on 20 different occupations. You know, the all 20 occupations actually have a lot of jobs in them. And we'll see whether there's anything that you find that you're liking or good at. So that's something else that I think would be good.
And do you want the public generally to be paying for this, or do you think that privatization, vouchers, and parents taking full control, as opposed to perhaps being moved into particular schools and the like, where would you go there in terms of how much choice and who's paying for it?
Right, yes, that's a great question. So, as you mentioned, you know, so, I mean, I do have a lot of libertarian sympathies, but my reading what's going on is quite a bit more complicated than what most people with my political philosophy believe in. You know, like philosophically, like I agree with separation of school and state, and I do say that in the book. But in terms of what this would actually accomplish, it's not clear to me this would actually lead to better teaching. I think it would lead to less, and that would be an improvement. I think people would be starting adult life at an earlier age, and I think that would be an improvement. But would a privatized school system actually focus more on making sure that everyone could read and write, or just that that their time is well spent, or just like I said, giving them more recess time when you don't have anything that students actually want to learn that they really need to know? The main thing about free education market is that it's going to respond to what parents are interested in, and honestly, I don't see the parents are all that dissatisfied with the general way that things work today. In fact, when I go to parent-teacher night, I see tons of happy faces. Parents seem to think the current system is great. So, there's been, a fair amount of academic work on, does school choice raise test scores? And it's a lot more mixed than you would think. And I think the best explanation is just that parents don't actually really want a school that improves their kids' test scores a lot. That's not really their focus. And, they have more of a focus on, does it seem to be, is this a school where you're mingling with other kids that are going to be going to college and that kind of thing? And a lot of it just seems a lot more emotional, and a lot of touchy-feely stuff seems to really appeal to parents today. So I think that if you had vouchers, say, that you'd still have a lot of that. I think the main thing that you can say that school choice does do is it does lead to kids being happier with the school experience. So I think that's underrated. But at the same time, I don't think there's much evidence that it would dramatically improve the actual educational outcomes or lead to people that are, much better at reading and writing or math, or actually even better prepared for their actual future. I wish it were otherwise, but that's the world that I see when I look at the numbers.
Do you think that America, because of our form of governance of schools, where it's done locally, community by community, with most of the overreach coming from the state itself, but having some play within that, is likely to create an experimental environment more so than many other societies or cultures? Or do you see some of the things you're talking about represented today in other cultures?
I think the U.S. is a little bit more experimental than other cultures. You do have countries like Japan where basically every school in the country for a given grade is teaching exactly the same subject. But I'd say, two things. So first of all, this is public sector competition, which is just never all that vibrant, because if you come up with a great product, the principal of that school doesn't get to take home $1 million or anything like that. In some ways, when you come up with a great product, it's a bigger pain in the neck because more people want to come to your school. There is a bit more room for variety, but it's just not all that dynamic. I think the other thing is I don't see much sign that many parents actually want something very different from what's going on. So, education is an area where parents tend to be very conformist, very sheep-like. They just want to be doing what other people are doing, and also just extremely deferential. It's striking to me how many times I've been at, a parent-teacher night, and the teacher has said, now, here's my philosophy of teaching. And the parents just sit there saying, oh, the teacher has a philosophy. We need to respect their philosophy and listen and follow this philosophy. And I'm there thinking, who are you to have a philosophy? Do you have any actual evidence on this? Why is it that because our kids were randomly assigned to your class that your philosophy should guide our children's education? Why don't you just focus on teaching them reading and writing and math and forget your philosophy? But, I mean, I look around and I'm the only person with this negative attitude in the room, so I don't think there's too much sign that if there were more parental choice, there'd be big change. There's, like, you know, deference to teachers seems to be very ingrained in, not just American society, but at least in our society from what I've seen.
Well, Brian, somebody might think that your child, because you seem to have gone to a lot of these parent-teacher meetings, as I have, that your child might be homeschooled or something, no?
My two older sons, we did start homeschooling them when in seventh grade, and I'm still doing that now.
Ah.
Two reasons. So, I mean, one is they were just getting less and less happy. And the other reason is that, you know, I'm in a position where I can do it easily and I enjoy it. So I am a professional educator. And, you know, so like this has worked out for us. I don't think of it as something that's a good solution for most families. But I mean, for me, I can just, you know, take my kids in to work with me, and, you know, they're very well behaved. So I just give them their work and I can do my job at the same time. And again, but also they were just so unhappy in regular school. They were so bored and frustrated with it. You know, since I do take this signaling story very seriously, that I was very concerned that my kids would suffer from a stigma from being homeschooled. So I did quite a bit of research on that, trying to find out in a modern environment how much do colleges discriminate against homeschoolers. And, you know, there I found out from people that seemed like they were level-headed and did not have a dog in the fight that, you know, modern colleges at most only have mild discrimination against homeschoolers, so that seemed like it would work out well for
us.
But
why put them back into the system? I mean, ultimately, you've taken them out, and you're teaching them yourself. What about sending them back into a system of higher education?
Right. Well, I mean, so there, what I'd say is that I don't see any sign that businesses would respect college-level homeschooling. So, basically, I think I would be really messing up their careers if I did something like that. So, again, I think it is vital to go and send them to college, again, not because colleges are such a great place to learn, but because this is where you go and get the stickers on your forehead. It's where you get the seal of approval. And, again, that's really the heart of my book, is that, this is the system that we live in, and there's not that much that one individual can do in order to break out of it. I mean, I do encourage my kids to always be looking for a back door, looking for a secret route where you can go and have a better life for yourself without the world penalizing you. But still, like, a lot of times, there's just no way around it. So,
yeah, and you do say that in the book. Yeah. I mean, you explain that graduation, at whatever level, is our society's top conformity signal, and that until you're ready to break all the molds. What about online education and really that ability to stimulate oneself and find just about any teacher in the world that you could imagine liking? I know I found some wonderful online teachers for some of the musical pursuits I have. What do you think about that?
Yeah, online education is a fantastic way to learn and satisfy your curiosity. Unfortunately, it's still not a good way to get a job.
Mm.
Right. So what I'd say is that from everything that I've seen, online education is just competing with blogs and YouTube videos and other kinds of edutainment. It's not the kind of thing where you can go and do Khan Academy and then go to employers and say, see, I've done Khan Academy, so even though I dropped out of high school, I'm a good worker. Right? It's just not, and again, there is the puzzle, like, why? Why is it employers see such a big difference between them? And I think ultimately just comes down to conformity. Like, if you are a conforming member of our society, you know you're supposed to go to a regular school and get regular credentials and be certified the regular way, and you aren't looking for some way to secede from the system. And when you do secede from the system, employers look at you with great suspicion, or again, more likely they just throw your application in the trash and you never even get a chance to tell your side of the story. Right? And as an employer, you can see why they're doing this, because, like, they're concerned. We don't want to hire someone weird or defiant or nonconformist. You know, there's no I in team, and, like, we need people that will just go along with the system. And so it makes sense for them to be unwilling to give chances to people that are doing things in a weird way. And yet it also means that if you are someone that wants to do it in a weird way, like your options are pretty limited. You can try a high-risk strategy, start your own business or something like that, but most people will fail at that, of course.
Well, we just interviewed Charlon Nemeth about her book, In Defense of Troublemakers, and all that you're saying about conformity, she certainly echoes. Well, the case against education, why the education system is a waste of time and money, Brian Kaplan. Thank you for stimulating us today on America Trends.
Thanks so much for having me. And you can get the book for just $20 on Amazon, so check it out.